comes from a sense of abundance. In his work, he's always bringing to light the harm that befell his clients, yet he manages only to see the good in life. That is so attractive, I wanted to run toward it. When someone is positive, successful, loving, inspirational, I gotta tell you right now, that shit is seductive. That is more enticing to me than six-pack abs and a chiseled jawline. Tom was excited to include me in his life and educate me about the law and what he does. If we went to dinner with another attorney and they discussed a case, they wouldn't just talk shop and ignore me. Tom would say, okay, Erica, listen to this. This is the case we're working on, and this is why he and I don't see things the same way. He would explain the particulars of the situation and the laws governing it. I would become a part of the conversation, and I'd walk away knowing something about the law. More important, I would feel included and valuable to the conversation. What do you think now that I've explained it to you? He would ask. Then both men would listen intently, I would give my opinion, and they paid the utmost attention. I found out later they were interested in a layperson's opinion of their case and its merits. That information comes in extremely handy when presenting arguments to a jury. But I liked how it made me feel. It was incredibly seductive. In my experience, most men are not really interested in teaching their partners shit. Rarely does a woman meet a man who will explain things to her without making her feel like he's talking down to her. Tom explains things in a way that's uplifting. It's like, oh, let me show you this. Let me exchange this knowledge with you. Tom would never mansplain something to me. He always values my intelligence, even if I wasn't educated on a particular topic of discussion. I've always been attracted to smart, successful men. I've dated people with more money than Tom. I've dated people in more powerful positions than him. But he was someone who included me in the conversation and never took my presence for granted. Tom loves the law. He loves to share his knowledge of it, and he wanted me to be a part of something he loves so much. He made me love it, too. I loved every minute of it. I thought it was cool, and I was there to listen and soak it all up. A few months after we started dating, I lost the lease on my apartment. I temporarily moved in with my friend Victor, who was nice enough to take me in. But that wasn't going to last forever. Where are you going to go? Tom asked when I told him about it. Oh, I'll figure it out, I said nonchalantly. These things, while stressful, always have a way of working themselves out. You know, my house is really big, Tom said. You could leave your stuff in my garage while you look for a place, or you could just stay there while you figure things out. I don't know, I told him. I didn't want to jump into anything. At that point, I'd only been to his house one other time when he cooked dinner for me. But after a few more weeks on Victor's couch, I reconsidered. We decided that I would live with Tom just as friends, and I would have my own bedroom down the hall from his. Before moving in, I got rid of all my IKEA furniture. That day at Tom's house, I just rolled up in my convertible. Where's all your stuff? Tom asked. It's here in these trash bags, I told him as we unloaded them out of the back seat. All you have is a car and your clothes? Yep. Okay. I thought you were going to have furniture and things. No, I don't have any of that. I got rid of it all. All right, then, he said. As I was thinking about what my life in that house would be like, I fully realized just how sparsely furnished it was. Tom had the basics, beds, a kitchen table, a couch, but you could tell a man lived there alone. Here we were, two adults in this huge house. Between us, we barely had any possessions at all. I set myself up in the room down the hall from Tom, which is the room where my son lives now. It's a large guest room with a big fireplace. Our split living arrangement was a little foolish, because every night I would sneak down the hall into Tom's bed, using him as my human body pillow. After a month, we dropped the pretense. I just moved into his bedroom. Slowly, we started acquiring furniture. Some chairs here, a bookcase there, but nothing that would blow your socks off. It was really just subsistence furniture. We carried on with this arrangement for a few months. I was still working at Chasen's, but one night Tom said, I think you should quit waitressing there. I agreed. None of the other staff knew that we were dating or that I was living with Tom, so it was a surprise when I gave notice. On my last night working there, everyone was asking me what my next job was going to be. Nothing, I told him. Really? My coworkers asked, confused. Randy knew what was going on the whole time because we were close friends, and he was happy for both of us. Erica, this is great. He really loves you, and you deserve this. You guys are cute together, he said. To get the approval of someone who knew both of us so well was very sweet. My last night at Chasen's, I took off that stretch velvet green gown for the last time. I'd been wearing it for more than a year, and it was starting to fray along the seams. I folded it up very neatly into a perfect square. You never forget your retail skills. I walked over to one of those industrial-sized gray rubber trash cans by the bar. I laid that green dress on top of the trash and added my pumps. It was a little funeral shrine. Closing the lid, I walked out of that restaurant and into a whole new life. Chapter 9, Giving the Layman's Opinion. Tom and I took our relationship public. Out at the country club or some other event, I would see some of the people I used to wait on at Chasen's. It was just like, hey, remember me? I always knew who was a cheap tipper, who was having an affair, who acted like an asshole, and who was actually a really cool person. But now I was meeting these people as an equal rather than as a member of the staff. It was hilarious that I went from being a cocktail waitress in a gown to being a cocktail party guest in a much nicer gown. I was still asking the same people, hey, how's it going, man? How are you? I'm sure some of them were scared because they knew exactly what I'd seen them up to. At first, I didn't always get a warm reception. I'm Tom's third wife, and he is a very successful, well-known attorney. People were seeing this 27-year-old walk in with him. Immediately, everybody thought I was going to have a baby so I could lock down some of his money. They didn't know I already had a child to take care of and was focused on doing what was right for him. His future was most important to me, not having another child. When I was first on the scene, plenty of the other wives weren't especially friendly. We were socializing with lawyers and Tom's other acquaintances, so many of them knew Tom's previous wives. They weren't hostile to my face, but I would overhear, oh, why is she wearing that? Or, why is her hair cut like that? Or, what is her motive? Quite honestly, I think they were looking at me like, holy shit. Am I next to be replaced? There were a couple of really nice, powerful, wealthy older women who befriended me. It was the wealthiest women who were the nicest. Some of them were second or third wives like me, and they had been in my same position before. The great part about having older women friends is that they've been through every part of the marriage. They've been sick, healthy, broken, wealthy. They've disciplined bad kids and dealt with mistresses. You name it, they've done it. I was visiting one of these women recently. She's very wealthy and well-known. She said, you're still the same 27-year-old little girl I met many years ago. You've never changed. You've always been this way, and I'm very proud of you. At hearing that compliment, I almost started to tear up at the table. This woman is famous in Los Angeles for wearing millions of dollars in jewelry at all times, as many of the women I was socializing with did. Early on in our relationship, I went to Tiffany and bought myself a small silver chain with a heart on it. It wasn't expensive. When Tom saw me wearing it, he got upset. You don't buy jewelry for yourself. That's my privilege. I get to do that, he told me. Tom, it wasn't very expensive. It's no big deal. That's what I like to do. I want to buy your jewelry. I don't care that it's small, he said. I always felt that was cool of him. He's bought me a ton of beautiful stuff, which I really love. Now I wear as much as I can on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills and in cast photos. I try to sneak in everything as a reminder of our time together. About 6 months after I temporarily moved into Tom's house in Pasadena, I got my most significant piece of jewelry. He took me out onto one of the balconies overlooking the lush backyard, got down on one knee, and asked me to marry him. He presented me with a beautiful diamond engagement ring. Of course I said yes. After our engagement, Tom said, listen, I'll buy you anything you want. I don't care what it is, you name it, but I'm not wearing a wedding band. I never have, I never will, I don't like it, it's uncomfortable. Please don't ask me to. I agreed with his request. Listen, a wedding ring does not have magical powers. It's not going to stop anyone from doing something. Whoever thinks his or her spouse is going to magically look down at their hand and all of a sudden not make a bad decision is a fool. I don't care if Tom doesn't wear a wedding ring. He doesn't mind if I don't wear mine on occasion either, though some people who watch the show make a big deal about it every time they spot me without it. Neither of us ever even thought to get a prenup. It never came up. Let's be serious. Mr. Girardi knows the law so well that a prenup is not going to do shit. As any lawyer will tell you, there is always a way around a prenup, even if you think it's ironclad. Tom was going to protect himself no matter what. And what did I need to protect? The little red convertible and trash bags full of clothes I rolled up with? At the time, neither of us really thought we'd ever need one. We were married 6 months later in January. Since it wasn't a first marriage for either of us, we didn't want to make the ceremony into a big ordeal. One day I was at home, and Tom called and said, "Judge Flynn can marry us today." Judge Paul Flynn, who became famous for presiding over Snoop Dogg's 1995 murder trial, is a good friend of Tom's. He agreed to officiate. I went down to the Gucci store and told Esther, the sales girl I bought from all the time, I was going to get married later that afternoon. We picked out a long, silvery satin dress that was quite pretty. Tom picked me up, and we went over to the L.A. Country Club. Judge Flynn came off the golf course and put his robe over his golf clothes to marry us in a small reading room in the clubhouse. Tom's best friend, Robert Baker, who defended O.J. Simpson in his civil trial, was there with us to serve as a witness. Judge Flynn said to us, "I think you need two witnesses for a marriage." "Hold on 1 minute," Tom said. He went into the bar looking for someone who could be our other witness. He saw Wayne Boley, a fellow lawyer. He said, "Hey, Wayne, Eric and I are getting married. Can you come over here and be our second witness?" This was the first time I had ever met Wayne, but he sure did us a solid. I mean, without him, Tom and I would still be living in sin. After the brief ceremony, Tom and I got into our car. We drove over to the airplane. Then we flew to Vegas to have dinner at our favorite place. It would be just the two of us at Michael's Gourmet Room at the now-demolished Barbary Coast Hotel. I called my grandmother from the car and told her we'd gotten married. She was excited because she knew how much I loved Tom. My grandmother especially loved Tom. When she would come to visit, she and Tom would get in his convertible and go grocery shopping at Bristol Farms. He would put one thing in the cart and she would take it out. You already have one of those at home," she would say. Had she been in the cupboards taking inventory all day? How did she know what we had? Finally, I had to tell her to let him do his shopping his own way. "Gramby," I said, "this is his house, and he's spending his money. If he wants to buy a million cans of asparagus, just let him." "But I know he already has two at the house," she'd insist. That was my grandmother, defiant and controlling to the very end, even with Tom. They always got along, though. He found it endearing that she was so concerned about his lack of thriftiness. Immediately, I started living Tom's life. It was a great legal education. I sat in so many meetings, dinners, and talks with the very best legal minds. I went to the U.S. Supreme Court to watch a session. A friend of ours, who was Attorney General for the state of California at the time, was arguing a case. Between the huge curtains in the court and the nine justices sitting there in that great room, it was truly impressive. Tom has always been very involved in politics. We would go to the Senate to meet people and talk to them on an intimate level. This was not the kind of meet and greet where you shake a politician's hand and get a picture with them. Yes, it's almost always a him. No, we would have dinner with the mayor and his wife, and we'd listen to what he thinks about the city's homeless problem. We would have drinks with the U.S. senator, and she'd confide in us the problems the senators were having with the current administration. These were some great experiences. It was a very busy and rewarding life for us. We'd be out most nights after work socializing and attending events until around midnight. We'd drive home together and listen to murder mysteries from the 30s and 40s on the radio. They were old radio plays. We'd ride silently in the car holding hands trying to figure out who the killer or thief was. That was always one of my favorite rituals. I was so sad when they took that off the air. Aside from being Tom's legal sounding board and voice of the layperson at dinners, I served other important functions too. At a business dinner with another couple, I would entertain the wife while Tom was trying to settle a case. I've had to do that a lot. Since Tom does so much business in social settings, my job as his wife is to help him close the deal. I have to be charming to everyone, even when sometimes I'd rather be at home watching Oprah's Super Soul Sunday. I'm also in charge of making sure that Tom's suits are laid out. His things are hung up in the closet, all paired out, each suit with a matching shirt and tie, as well as belts, socks, and shoes. I'm in charge of making sure that he has everything that he needs, that he has his particular toothpaste and his particular cologne. I enjoy being able to do that for him. I think it shows that I care and I want him to have fewer things to worry about. Getting him ready shows that I took the time to think of him. He's not going to do it for himself, so if he walks out of the house looking crazy, that makes both of us look bad. I try to always make sure he looks like a million bucks. If something blows up around the house, do not ask Tom to fix it. Do not ask him to wash the clothes, put away the dishes, or hang up his laundry. I take care of as much of that as I possibly can. But if you want to know anything about the law or how the legal system works, he is a treasury of knowledge. He knows everything there is to know on the subject. I can handle the rest or hire someone who can. Now that I'm busier with my own career, Tom helps me out as well. He will bring home dinner when he knows I haven't eaten. If he's having a dinner meeting, he'll call and say, "Hey, I'm at Morton's tonight. I know you're in the studio. Would you like me to bring you home a steak?" That's what being a partner is all about. It's not just about smooches or trying to look all cute and romantic and selfies. It's the most mundane things that help your other half get out there and be the best that he or she can be. Period. I feel like women have these unrealistic expectations in marriage. As if somehow or another, Prince Charming is going to ride up on a white horse, pay all her bills, listen to all her problems, and want to hang out with her and her friends. I got news for you, honey. They don't want that. They want your support just as much as you want theirs. It's not all sunshine and unicorns in the Girardi household. Like any couple, we can really get on each other's nerves. He can be a brat, and I can be an even bigger brat. He hates it when I talk over him, or when he hasn't completely finished saying something. And I'm like, "But wait a minute, what about this and this?" I get impatient with him because he can be very long-winded. He thinks I'm being bratty and pushy. He'll respond, "If you'd let me finish, I'll answer those questions, Erica." Sometimes I feel like he's trying to lecture me, but he always ends up giving good advice and good information. It's usually something I would have missed. Tom wants me to say everything I want to say. He just wants me to deliver it with a softer touch and to wait my turn. He wants everyone to play by the rules, like we're in a courtroom. There's one thing that Tom has been doing our entire relationship that drives me insane. It will keep happening as long as we're together. He'll say, "Hey, we have to go to this thing on Friday." "Okay. What thing?" I'll ask. "Oh, I don't know. It's like a lawyer thing." "Well, where is it?" "I don't know. It's on the website." "Well, is it a house, a restaurant, a theater, a palace?" I think it's like a cocktail party." When we get there, it's a formal dinner at someone's house. I'm dressed like we're going to a cocktail party. Again. Tom says every event is no big deal. And when we get there, it's an intimate sit-down dinner with three heads of state, the Pope, and Barbara Streisand. Tom can't describe it in such a way that I can prepare. For the record, my example is fictional. I've never been to dinner with the Pope. I have been to dinner with Barbara Streisand. It was at a Clinton fundraiser where we were sat at a table of six and talked about her performances. No matter what the occasion, Tom always says, "Just put on some lip gloss and fluff your hair up." "Seriously?" I'll say to him, "You do want me to show up looking beautiful, right?" "Yes, of course." "Do you realize that takes time?" "Well, what does it take, like 45 minutes? "No, sweetheart, it takes 3 days. Well, we can get on each other's nerves a little. We rarely have giant arguments. One of the best things Tom ever did for me was keep me from fighting dirty. I think I learned from my mother some ways of talking to people that can be very damaging. For example, how to cut someone deeply with words. I did a lot of that in my first marriage. It always made things worse, and I regret it. The first time I ever tried that with Tom, he put a stop to it very quickly. "You don't talk like that," he told me. Notice it wasn't, "You don't talk to me like that." He was telling me, "I mustn't say awful things to anyone, especially the people I love, no matter how justified I feel in the moment." When words leave your mouth, they're irretrievable. There is no argument for which winning justifies collateral damage. I've learned not to lash out and call names, but try to explain why I'm angry or upset. Tom doesn't like screaming in our house. That's not the way to get his attention. As soon as I would raise my voice, I've already lost him. Over time, Tom's family and my own began to meld. I even started spending holidays with him and his children from his previous marriage and his grandchildren. What was so strange to me was that it was actually enjoyable. There were no fights breaking out, and nobody was mad at someone else. After one Thanksgiving I called home, I said, "You know what, Renee? I was with Tom's family today, and they all got along. There wasn't any drama. What's wrong with our country-ass family? I didn't hear even once, "Well, look at her fat ass." I never liked her. I didn't want to eat her ambrosia salad anyway. What was most important to me is that Tom treated my son very well. He made it possible for me to give him the best of everything. After Tom and I were married, and I had my West Coast life figured out, my son was 6. He decided that he'd rather stay in Manhattan and finish school while living with his father. Even though his school was back east, I was at every teacher conference, school play, graduation, and any other event I thought I should attend. I was always actively involved in my son's upbringing and education, especially when he was in elementary school. I would fly back to New York every 7 to 10 days. I was on a first-name basis with the American Airlines flight attendants. They would all tell me to say hi to my son for them. One of my favorite memories is from when my son was in elementary school, maybe 5th or 6th grade. The Yankees were in the World Series. Tom and I woke up in L.A., flew to Oklahoma. Tom argued a case. We got back on our plane, flew to New York, picked up my son, took him to the Bronx, saw the Yankees win, took him back home, kissed him goodbye, told him I'd be back in a week, got on our plane and came home to fall asleep in our own bed. We did that all in one day. Whenever we go to New York, we drag my son to every musical in town. Tom and I both love the theater. One Christmas vacation, we went on safari in Africa. We celebrated New Year's Eve by having relay races with my son on the Serengeti plain. The guide had to drive his truck around the area to make sure there were no lions around. Later, we hired a tutor and took him out of school for 2 weeks so he could travel Europe with us. We'd take this kid everywhere we possibly could. The poor guy has been to more lawyer events than I could wish on anyone. Tom and my son always had a special bond. Their birthdays are 3 days apart. Since they're both Geminis, it's like each is the twin the other was promised. When my son was 6 or 7, we would meet Tom for dinner. Tom drove there separately in his convertible Aston Martin. One time after dinner, I visited the ladies' room, and when I came back, the table was empty. They decided to play a prank on me by leaving together in Tom's car. I would have been upset if it wasn't so adorable. Every summer, my son would go to Tom Sawyer Day Camp in Altadena, California. It's right near our house. When that was finished, he would work in the law firm for the rest of the summer. He would carry Tom's briefcase, get coffee, run errands, and sometimes go to court with Tom. That's why he's so comfortable in court as a police officer. He was practically raised there. When my son was in his probationary year at LAPD, he was stationed downtown. He patrolled the area near Tom's office. One day, something happened on the sidewalk in front of the office. Lynn, the firm's receptionist, is a tough broad from New Jersey. She spotted my son in uniform handling the incident. She gathered a small crowd of lawyers pressing their noses against the glass to watch him in action. They had known him since he was 6, and now he was a grown man policing their street. When we first got married, I was busy being a mother and wife, but I had other things to do as well. Tom loves to golf, so I decided I'd learn how to play. I started going to the Wilshire Country Club to take lessons with the pro a couple of times a week. I'd also play with my old friend Randy, who worked with me at Chasen's. He and I played on the public course where we used to get chased by coyotes. When I figured out that golf is a lot like dancing, I started to get pretty good. It's about precise movement, shifting your body at the right time and being fluid in your movement. One day, Tom and I were playing at Bel Air Country Club. We both put our balls in the first tee and hit them out into the fairway. We pulled up to the ball furthest from the hole, the lesser shot. Tom said, "This is yours." I got out of the cart and looked at the ball. "No, honey," I said, "this is Titleist 2. I'm Titleist 3. This is your ball." I had outdriven Tom on the first hole. That was the last time we ever played golf together. I can't say that I mind. While I love being out on the beautiful courses and driving the cart, I never had the patience to play a full round the way he does. About 8 years after moving into Tom's partially furnished home, we decided it was time to redo the whole house. This would include all the furniture. Tom had been living there since he bought it in the 70s, and it had been redecorated about 10 years before I got there. It looked a lot like the Steakhouse Houston's, with dark, imposing woods and low lighting. In the previous remodel, the 1920s-era house had been stripped of all its character. Thank God the interior designer left the important parts, like the bronze front door that allegedly came off a Spanish galleon, the bronze central staircase, the travertine floors, and Colombian crotch-grain mahogany walls. Upstairs were bedrooms which would be considered small by modern HGTV standards for the owners of the house, along with servants' quarters. We redid the upstairs to make the bedrooms larger and added bathrooms. I firmly believe in saying that the secret to a happy marriage is having separate closets and bathrooms, so those were a must in our house. When I restored the house, I reintroduced all the great woods, moldings, and Venetian plasters. I imported some really beautiful antique fireplaces and ridiculously gorgeous tiles. I've looked at a lot of fucking houses, and you're going to have to search high and low to beat my finished carpentry. I wasn't fortunate enough to get the original plans for the house, so I couldn't fully restore it the way the architect intended. I had to go with what I thought was best, keeping with the time period, and then adding my own signature to it. It took about a year and a half to renovate the whole house. While construction was taking place, we moved into our Malibu beach house. Now that it's finished, the house is huge, but it only has three bedrooms, one for me and Tom, one for my son, and one for guests. The guest room doesn't get used very often because I don't like to have guests. I've never been the kind of person to invite a lot of people over to my home. We always entertain at a restaurant, a lounge, or somewhere outside of the house. If someone is invited to my home, it's a big deal. My home is a place where I recharge and escape. It's best when it's calm and serene, and I can enjoy peace and solitude. I didn't grow up with siblings or a big family. I get stressed out if a place is too noisy, even for just a few hours to host a cocktail party. I'd rather do it somewhere else. I know this is all ironic because the crew of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills comes to the house all the time. At least this way people can see the house on television, and I can still have it quiet most of the time. For the first decade I was married to Tom, I worked on projects like that. But let's be honest, I was really well known on Rodeo Drive, too. My closet was full of every kind of dress, shoe, and bauble imaginable. My son was getting older and needing me less. The house was restored and redecorated. I wanted something more. That's when I started to think about performance again. For a while, I put my career aspirations on hold to tend to Tom. But I needed that time to grow as well, to really come into my own and learn a few things about myself. Only then did I feel ready to get back out there into the grind of showbiz. Tom has given me many things, but the sweetest thing he's ever done in my life is believe in me. Renee was my cheerleader and made sure that I got to class. She ensured I had everything I needed growing up, but my husband is the one who really and truly made me feel like I was okay as a human. That I was bright, and my opinions and knowledge mattered. He is the foundation of my strength, confidence, and tenacity. I watched him for so long. I watched the way he treats others, the way he leads, the way he loves his firm, and the law. He is very sure of himself. It's like he taught me just by example how to do all those things myself. He made me feel comfortable in my own skin. Now that I was finally comfortable in it, the time had come to shed that skin, to let a whole new version of myself be born. Her name, of course, is Erica Jane. Chapter 10, Fantasy, Love, Escape. Erica Jane is an escape artist. She's not here to cure cancer or create world peace. She's here to offer people a bit of fun. She exists so people who are pressed flesh to flesh on the dance floor can think about her huge blonde hair, her conspicuous consumption, and her zero fucks attitude rather than their own troubles, if only for a minute. But Erica Jane helped Erica Girardi escape as well. I married Tom in 2000 and immediately started living his life for the next 7 or 8 years. I traveled with him, attended his professional events, and watched him get awards. During that time, all I had to worry about was helping Tom and taking care of my boy. It's easy to lose yourself in the shadow of a powerful man, which I said on The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills reunion. It's something I learned from personal experience. There'll be plenty of people who will say, "Oh, that would never happen to me." If you say that, you probably never met a really powerful man. My feelings about being in Tom's shadow changed when I got a simple piece of mail. It was a postcard featuring a picture of a woman Tom and I both knew. At the time, she was married to one of Tom's colleagues who owns his own firm and does very well for himself. I had heard that she started a singing career and thought, well, that's cool. This was an invitation to her first concert. I can still clearly see the image. This woman is tall, blonde, European, and in the photo, she was wearing a red satin slip dress and standing at a microphone. Her cascade of hair was styled to cover her left eye. It was as if Veronica Lake was doing a cabaret show. The card had her name, the place of the performance, and the date. Then, at the bottom, in small type, it said, directed by Travis Payne. This may not mean a lot to somebody else, but Travis was like a brother to me. We went to Northside High in Atlanta together, and we were in the same performing arts program. We traveled around the world as members of the school's tour show, and he starred in the production of Pippin that I got suckered into our senior year. Immediately after graduation, Travis was catapulted into the big leagues. He was dancing on tour with Janet Jackson when he was 19. Travis has had an amazing career, choreographing for everyone like Madonna, En Vogue, TLC, Lady Gaga, and all the greats. He has 4 MTV Music Video Awards for Best Choreography. He worked extensively with Michael Jackson and was working on the This Is It tour when the King of Pop died. I thought, this lady must be taking it seriously if she can afford Travis Payne. Travis and I kept in touch after school and we were friends in L.A. I would attend his shows and he would invite me to his epic house parties. I hadn't talked to him in about a year, but I decided this postcard was good enough reason to pick up the phone and say hi. Hey, I got this invitation at my house, I told him when he answered. This is fucking crazy. Yeah, it was kind of a cool project, he said. I was curious how he got involved with this particular woman, because I'd never known him to work for anyone of her level, to be perfectly honest. Well, what are you up to? This is all possible for you, too, he said. Ask anyone. Well, if she can do it, I can do it, I said to him, bratty as usual. You absolutely should, he said. Let me show you what's possible. You need to be performing again. Travis really took me off the bench and saved me. When people are not being their true selves, there's that level of disappointment that turns into anger, resentment, and misery. You see it everywhere in the world, the weight of unrealized dreams. I wasn't going to go down like that. Starting the Erika Jayne Project was an act of rebellion against everything society told me I should be doing. I should be thankful, pretty, soft, appreciative, quiet, and excited someone rescued me. I had all the things you could have in life when you're 35. A beautiful home, a black MX, and a Gulfstream. My kid goes to a great private school with the best tutors and has the best orthodontist. That should be enough. It should be enough to be married to someone who is famous in his career and is influential and changes laws. It should be enough to go to the White House and meet the president. But it wasn't. None of it was enough. I had never realized my own dream. I looked at those people at the White House and highbrow functions I would attend with Tom. Then I looked at myself, and I saw no difference. Why not me? Why can't I have success? My husband also gave me a great gift in that he showed me old ways of thinking are just that. He told me things can happen, but you have to make them happen. I'm never afraid to be a hard worker. There is a trick to life, and Tom knows it. When you're with someone as smart and aggressive, and some would say, Machiavellian, as he is, it's impossible not to become a student, and I am his best fucking protege. This is what I was thinking about when Travis set up a meeting with the two of us and Peter Rafelson. Peter is a music producer who helped the woman on the invitation create her project. He also co-wrote Madonna's Open Your Heart, along with dozens of other hits for Stevie Nicks, Britney Spears, and all sorts of artists. At the meeting, Peter explained, we can create a project, we can create records, and they can be distributed digitally. This is how things work these days. I kept saying to him, how is this possible? I didn't think it could actually be real. I was under no illusions about the music industry. I was a 35-year-old woman. There was no way I was going to walk arms swinging into Capitol Records and walk out with a record contract. They're looking for the next teenager they can mold into a machine that mints money. What Peter and Travis were offering was something else. I could carve out my own lane, creating my own project, putting it out there ourselves over the internet and directly into the hands of DJs and consumers and hoping that it caught on. But it was more than that to me. It was a return to a part of myself that I loved, but had allowed to languish, which is being a performer. When I created Erica Jane, it was with no expectations other than reawakening the dragon inside. I told them this sounded great, but I needed to go home and talk to Tom about it. I brought it up that very night. Tom, I have what I think might be a very interesting opportunity to create again, and I'd really like to do it, I said. I think this is a good time for me, and I feel that in my heart. I feel like I need to do this. It's what I know how to do. Tom being Tom wanted to see something on paper, so I went back to Peter and we put together a document outlining a production budget, including songs, timelines, studio sessions, and everything. I brought that back to Tom so he could see what it looked like. This sounds great, he told me. This is going to be fun. He was 1,000,000,000% supportive. You know the reason I believe he was supportive? Because I'm 1,000,000,000% supportive of him. I've never involved myself in his business. I've never offered unsolicited advice. I've never gotten involved in office politics. I've never done anything other than cheerlead, believe in him, and be present for him. And when the time came for him to be present for me, he was. The truth is, and I don't think he'd ever admit it now, I don't think he thought we'd be seeing any number one singles on the dance club charts. I don't think he really believed this was going to lead to everything that it has. Boy, did I show him. The whole Erica Jane project was only possible because I'm self-funded. Now, the haters are going to say, all you do is spend your husband's money. First of all, it's our money. Know how I know? Because the IRS tells me that it is. My name is on the tax return, too. Second, yes, I have the advantage of a strong checkbook, but I'll tell you what. You can write all the fucking checks you want, but that doesn't guarantee success. That's been proven many times. A record label could write as many checks as it wants, and certain acts aren't getting off the ground. Look at all the checks the losing candidate in an election writes every year. Look at the checks people put into their businesses that don't get off the ground. Does money help everything? Of course. Is it a guarantee of success? No. Tom gives me 2 gifts a year, a birthday present and a Christmas present. When this project started, I said to him, no Christmas present and no birthday present. My project is my present. That is the gift you can give me. He agreed. He kept his word, but every now and then he will say at Christmas, well, sweetheart, I can't give you nothing. Now, admittedly, it is small, but it's still fabulous. So I started working 8 hours a day, 4 days a week with Peter in the studio. He was always asking me these kinds of questions. Who do you like? Who inspires you? What are your goals? He showed me the way to express myself through song and writing music. He was never critical of any of my ideas. Instead, he would ask, can you flesh that out? What's a better way to say that? How do we translate that into a song? I would bring in phrases, poems, and pictures, the things that were inspiring me and were going through my head, and we would make those into song ideas. That's how we created the song Pretty Mess, which became the name of the album, the record label, and my Instagram account, and this book, probably the inscription on my tombstone. We were writing one day in the studio, and Peter was seated at his keyboard underneath his massive monitors. I was standing next to him, leaning over, and we were both looking at the words on the monitor. We were writing out words like princess and temptress, and I said, pretty mess. Peter said, hey, wait, what is that? Oh, it's stupid, I said, still a little unsure. No, it's actually kind of cool, he said, let's keep it. So we just wrote it down. Then I was thinking about all the different roles you have to play as a woman. Sometimes you're a temptress. Sometimes you're a princess. Sometimes you're a pretty mess. I wrote it out first as a poem. Everything you see you want. Everything I am I bought. It speaks to the facade of Erica Jane as a character. Something that was still in its infancy when I was thinking about it, but it always had that notion of fantasy, love, and escape. Those are the 3 words that really guided her birth. Fantasy, love, escape. I wrote them down one day, and everything that we did had to go back to that mission statement. Later, I would add glitz, glamour, fun. Those 6 words are the set pieces that support the illusion of Erica Jane. In every song, every performance, every video, and every costume, it all comes back to those 6 concepts. The name Erica Jane was kind of a mistake. I wanted to just be Erica, but then it's too close to Madonna or Cher. I hadn't exactly earned one name status quite yet. Peter finally said, the only thing that goes with Erica is Jane. Fine, whatever, I said, giving up and hating it a little. Then I read that Joan Crawford hated her stage name because it sounded like Joan Crawfish. And then I started to equate Jane with Jane Mansfield, whom I loved, and started to grow on me. This period of creation was really special for me because it was pure expression. There was no corporate executive saying, this other artist has a hit single and you need to sound like her. There were no expectations. Nobody else knew I was doing this except Tom and Renee. Even if people knew, no one would have cared what the final outcome would have been. No one expected this to go anywhere, so Peter and I could just create exactly what we wanted to without any interference. The first song we recorded was Give You Everything. Peter was still trying to figure out how well I could sing. If I sing this, can you sing it back, he asked. I was there in the booth with headphones on, and I opened my mouth for the first time in a decade. I sang it back to him exactly as he sung it to me. You make me want to give you everything. Wow, Peter replied. It was perfect. That was the take that we used on the record. I nailed it. That's how I knew this was the right thing to do, and I was in the right place. Life gives you little signs, and it was something small, but to me it meant everything. Life said, you're supposed to be here. But then it said, okay, now go work for it. Not everything was as easy as that first take, especially when we started performing again. That's where Travis really came in with the production, the choreography, the costumes, and helping me create the package to support the music. When we started rehearsing, it was so strange that I really had the jitters. Why am I so nervous? Why do I feel crazy? I thought. I've been dancing and performing since I was a little kid. I felt like it should be second nature to me. One day, I expressed this to Travis. You know, Erica, when you step away and try to come back, you get scared, he said. That's just the way it is. Now get your fucking ass back out there. I had to get comfortable with feeling uncomfortable. You really have to live and breathe in those moments because that's where the growth is. The growth isn't when things are good. It's when it's horrible and you stay in it. You improve when you're unsure and it's a struggle. We all have to look stupid and feel like shit in order to evolve. My goal was to make music and start performing again. A lot of the things I had to go through to get there were painful. But if you cower in those moments of pain, you will never have anything. I thought, what the fuck are you doing? You've spent this money, you've invested in yourself. You just gotta stick it out. That's a lot of it. So much of life is sticking it the fuck out. Finally, we got our first gig. It was at a San Francisco sex party called the Nymphomaniacs Ball at some place called Pleasure Zone. It was for straight people, if you can believe it. The DJ had gotten his hands on my music and loved it, and he invited me to come perform 3 songs. Travis hooked me up with the costume designer Zaldi, a former club kid who's made costumes for Britney Spears, Madonna, Lady Gaga, and worked with Gwen Stefani on her fashion line. He does all of RuPaul's costumes for RuPaul's Drag Race, and worked with Travis on the costumes for Michael Jackson's This Is It tour. He made me a few rompers. One was fuchsia, and one was pale diamond color, plus an amazing blue catsuit with diamonds on the shoulder. I decided to wear the catsuit for that first night. I was excited to tell Tom the news. So, we got hired by this sex club. It's kind of like a party. They have once every couple of months. I don't know exactly, but I'm going to go perform. Great, hun, go do it, he said. They're going to pay me, I told him. Oh, even better, he said. He was excited to see everything I'd been working on and be there for the first show, so he decided to come with me. That always surprises people that Tom would come to a sex party to see me. But let me tell you something. Mr. Girardi doesn't care. Tom's seen it all, done it all, doesn't care. People think because Tom's older and is a well-respected attorney that he must be prim and proper and a stick in the mud. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nothing fazes Tom. And at the end of the night, he even collected my check from the promoter like he was my business manager. I showed up at the venue, which was a huge old theater with a gigantic stage. I had 4 backup dancers and my tracks on a CD, which is funny to think about in the digital age. It had been billed as a sex party, but it wasn't really a scandalous orgy or anything. It was mostly couples, and mostly Asian. There was a lot of making out going on, but that was about all I saw. It seemed like the kind of joint couples would go to in order to find a willing third. If Erica Jane can help set the mood for such assignations, she's absolutely happy to oblige. I was really hyped to be there, and the DJ was hyped to have us too. I got out on stage and did our first song, and it was going well. From the stage, I could see the DJ in his setup at the foot of the stage, and he was freaking out over the performance. He was dancing and flailing his arms around and just really getting into the whole experience. I finished the first song and started into the second, and the DJ started freaking out again. I was happy to have the positive feedback, but he got so into dancing that he hit his DJ rig and pulled the whole thing down. All the wires got pulled out, the lighting board crashed to the ground. Suddenly we were on stage, standing in silence, mortified, while a bunch of confused Asian swingers shot us dirty looks. I remember standing there thinking, I should know what to do here, but I had no clue. It's not like we were going to sing a cappella. What does someone do? Someone in the crowd shouted, "Start over!" But you just can't start the show over. Still stunned, I shouted, "Thank you very much. Have a nice night." I walked off stage. The DJ hadn't just exploded his equipment. He'd also blew up my whole experience. After that first performance, I thought, oh, wait a fucking second. That'll never happen again. I made sure that everything was tight for every performance going forward. Not just my dancers' costumes and singing, but that everything would be technically perfect as well. I wasn't going to let another spastic DJ ruin my show. Having performed all my life as a young person, I knew the feeling of accomplishment of giving a good show. I didn't get that the first time out, or even the second time out. It took me a while to find my groove and get my proficiency back. Even though I wasn't having good shows right away, I knew what the payoff would feel like. So I just had to push through until I got to that other side. I knew that would come from just doing it over and over. I said yes to every show in every dive bar. I've performed on tables, in VIP areas, with no lights, in trains, and on nude beaches. I have performed everywhere. Anywhere someone wanted Erica Jane to perform, she said yes. There are two reasons for that. Number one, because I love it, and number two, because I love it. The audiences weren't always great. Some people were really into it and knew the project. Some people didn't care. Some people were just assholes. However, there was one thing they couldn't do. They couldn't stop looking. I knew that meant I was on the right track. Performing wasn't the only way we were getting the word out about Erica Jane. Peter, Travis, and I went to the Winter Music Conference in Miami a couple of times. It's an event where lots of pop acts and electronic music stars can break out by getting their music into the hands of producers, DJs, remix artists, promoters, and all sorts of people in the industry. The first single from the Pretty Mess album was Roller Coaster. Strippers used to tell me they loved to dance to the song, which was the greatest compliment I could ever receive. We decided to make a music video for the song to try to get it more exposure. I went to Travis and Peter and told them that I had access to the historic Stardust Casino in Las Vegas. At the time, Tom was on the board of Boyd Gaming, which owned the casino. It was about to be demolished, but there was a window where we could get inside with a camera crew. Then I told them that Tom and I were going on our annual Christmas trip, which we used to do with about 50 other couples. This year, it would be in the Bahamas, and I told them they could come with a small crew. "I can work with that," Peter said, and he wrote a treatment for the video. The story is something about me having a relationship with a mobster and running away to an island paradise with his employee. I'm abducted to a desert island before escaping once again with my lover who carries me around shirtless in a pool. I mean, it was kind of cliche and all over the place, but what do you want? We were working with what we had. I was just starting out and we were making it up as we went along. Travis choreographed it, and you can see him dancing on stage with me at the Stardust along with another dancer. I mean, looking back at it, it's probably kind of dumb, but I had access to this great shit, so why not use it? I was doing what every first-timer does, making the most of the resources I had. It was almost a year between when I started working with Peter to when Roller Coaster was my first number one hit on the dance charts. The day I got the call from Peter is a very special memory for me. I was in Georgia visiting my family for my birthday, which is July 10th. I was at my grandmother's house, standing in the driveway. It was, as they say in hell, hot as Georgia in July. I got a phone call and Peter said, "I just want to let you know that the song is number one on the dance club chart." It would later go on to be the number 13 song on Billboard's year-end dance club chart for 2007. Not bad for a rookie. That's amazing, I told him. Then I got to share the news with the rest of my family, including my cousin Jeremy, who was standing with me in the driveway when I got the call. He was even more excited than I was. My grandparents were sick at the time, so it was nice that they could be there to share in my success. Tragically, Jeremy died a few years later when his home burned down. After the fire, Renee and I went by his house. Out on the lawn near the front door were some things that he had tried to save by throwing them out the front door as it burned. Among those things was a copy of my first CD. At the funeral, I told my uncle that I'd seen it there on the lawn. He was playing it all the time, my uncle said enthusiastically. I had to tell him, "You need to give poor Erica a rest." It's nice to have that memory with Jeremy in the driveway. It was a special moment. It means a lot that he enjoyed my music and he was proud of me. In that year, I had to overcome a lot of obstacles and got back to one of the things that I loved the most. And when I had my first number one single, I proved a lot of people wrong. There were plenty of people who think I couldn't do it. "Well, you know, it's a really tough business and you're way too old," people would say condescendingly at cocktail parties when they heard about my new venture. They thought I was starting from scratch. They thought I was just some bored housewife who woke up at 35 and thought she was going to start singing and dancing. But no, motherfucker, that's not it. They had no idea that I was trained. I had lived this life before, and I had not only the skill, but also the determination to make it work. The internet also made all this possible. Being able to digitally distribute our music ripped the cover off the industry, and all the old rules were out the window. That made it possible for ancient artists like myself to find a foothold and be discovered, appreciated by fans, and able to sell records. It was so great to have people ask, "Oh, how's your little singing and dancing thing coming along?" I would say, "Oh, it's good, it's good." I didn't need to enumerate my success or tell them I'm Billboard's number 42 dance track artist of all time to prove them wrong. I knew I had accomplished what I set out to do. And I wasn't lying. It was going well. When I listen to Pretty Mess Now, there are some great songs on there, but not all of it's amazing. It sounds like a beginning. You can point back to any singer's first album, any director's first film, or any author's first book and see the mistakes they made. But you can also see what is great about them. That album is like a fawn standing up on four legs and learning to walk. It's a little wobbly, but it gets there. You can hear the creation, right or wrong, good or bad, of something. I like to say that without Erica Jane, Erica Girardi would just be another rich bitch with a plane. That is true. After all those years of living Tom's life, there was nothing more I could buy. There were no clothes collections, no garages full of cars, no amount of anything that was going to bring me the level of satisfaction that I have today. Without my project, I would have been relegated to a life of shopping, sitting on a few charity boards of no consequence, and standing silently by my husband's side, full of unrealized potential. That was what I was expected to do. Instead, I do what I love. I create. Even more than anyone else needed Erica Jane to escape, I did. Chapter 11. Glitz, Glamour, Fun. My first live performance with my creative director, Mikey Menden, was at Los Angeles Pride in 2009. This is a huge weekend-long gay pride concert that attracts such major acts that LA Weekly calls it Gay Coachella. It culminates in a giant concert on Sunday night when all of West Hollywood comes out to party. That year, we were performing on the smaller stage where the lesser-known acts appeared during the day as all the L's, G's, B's, T's, and Q's enjoyed themselves under the rainbow flags in the hot June sun. I hired Mikey, a skilled choreographer, to up Erica Jane's performance game, and that's what he did for Pride. He put me on stage with four male dancers and had us work every inch of ourselves for the crowd. I was wearing a gray, black, and silver Brian Lichtenberg cat suit with a middle corset and, of course, a pair of knee-high Chanel boots. All of a sudden, in the middle of the set, I rolled my ankle, almost like it collapsed on itself. It was a combination of me getting a little too enthusiastic in my performance, overliving, as Mikey would say, and the stage being slippery. This wasn't the first time it had happened to me, and it happens to every performer at times during her career. Yes, even Beyonce. There I was, crouched down for a moment and a bit stunned, and I looked up at Mikey, who was standing in the wings of the stage. He looked straight into my eyes and shook his head from right to left as if to say, "Bitch, do not give up. If you give up right now, you're dead." I will never forget that one little movement, because that was just what I needed. Someone to remind me that the key to being a great performer is rolling with whatever happens, thinking on your feet, and being comfortable with being uncomfortable. My dancer, Sean Breathwaite, bent down and picked me up, and I continued on like nothing happened. Let me tell you, this was no little sprain. It got quite painful, but I never let the crowd know there was anything wrong. With that little bit of pushy encouragement, Mikey and I forged a bond that can't be broken. I had first met Mikey while I was still promoting singles from the Pretty Mess album, and I felt like Erika Jayne needed a change. You know when artists become stale? It's when they stop challenging themselves and become complacent. You have to keep the collaborative vein open. Once you close that down, once you're not willing to look outside and say, "Wow, that's a new, fresh take on something," that's when you become uninspired and not fresh. Trust me, I'm always fresh, and we're always bringing in young talent to reinvigorate the act. I was introduced to Mikey through the late Jerry Heller, the manager who was behind the rap group NWA. Tom had once provided Jerry and NWA rapper Eazy-E with some legal advice. Jerry's nephew was doing some road managing for me and said, "You know who you need to meet? This kid Mikey Minden, he's amazing." At that time, Mikey was the creative director for the Pussycat Dolls show in Las Vegas. He really helped Pussycat Dolls creator Robin Anton take her creation to the next level. What he was doing there was very much in line with the hair-whipping, floor-working insanity that is Erika Jayne. He was only 24 years old when we met at a restaurant. He walked in, bold and confident, in full Mikey regalia, with arms full of bracelets, fingers full of rings, and his then-signature perfectly waxed brows. Before he even sat down, he said to me, "Have we met before?" I don't think we ever had, but it was almost like we did. He's one of those people I just hit it off with on so many levels. A month later, after we shot the Give You Everything video, I was at his 25th birthday party at Apple Lounge in West Hollywood. We have been friends and collaborators ever since. He perfectly understood Erika Jayne and what I was trying to do with her. Both Travis and Peter had worked with the greats of the music industry and lent a certain amount of polish to our work together. They thought Erika Jayne should be a perfect sparkling diamond. Immediately, Mikey brought his grit in youthful defiance to the project. It's like he was saying, "Oh, you think you're fancy, Erika? Let me show you what I think." Mikey re-examined everything I'd done so far. Everything with Peter and Travis was technical, but with Mikey it was raw and rule-breaking. He saw something different, and we were able to expand on it and keep going, which is really cool. I was reaching into my gut and figuring out what this project was, who I wanted to embody, and what I wanted to say. There's a theme to the whole Erika Jayne experience, which is ripping off the layers of myself to get to the person inside. It's about being comfortable enough to reveal the darker, sexier secret side that polite society frowns upon, that all of us have lurking in our subconscious and that's dying to get out. The best thing about our working relationship is that we really push each other. If I wanted to push any limit, or what I felt was pushing a limit, Mikey would say to me, "Bullshit, you should go further, and let me tell you why." He encouraged me to really be free, be fearless, and embrace this entire over-the-top, provocative doll character we created. The first thing we worked on together was a music video for Give You Everything, which was the first track we recorded for Pretty Mess, but the third single I released. I already had a director and a concept for the video. Basically, it's a little story about me falling in love with a guy who is trying out to be one of my dancers. There were a bunch of dance breaks, and Mikey came in to choreograph those. I already had the hair and makeup in place, but Mikey suggested a team of stylists as well. Just like me, he thinks wardrobe is where the character really comes out. Those costumes lent an edgier and fresher vibe, for sure. We went up to film the video at a public elementary school in Santa Barbara. They had the most beautiful theater I've ever seen in my life. It was Spanish mission style that had been completely restored and was full of top-of-the-line equipment. It was absolutely stunning. The next video was going to be for the song Pretty Mess. I had such a great time with Mikey on Give You Everything that I gave him even more control over this video. He co-directed it with the photographer Mike Ruiz, but now he was taking on the role of creative director as well as doing the choreography. With this video, Mikey and I were able to make the vision tighter and more our own. We wanted to focus more on the performance, fashions, and lifestyle. We wanted to build up that persona.